And now,
the definition. Definition.
As the rest of the world waits for a formal transition to begin, what is the difference between Trump's behavior and that of some international autocrats? That is what many people are asking. And our next guest has been writing about authoritarianism for two decades. Masha Gessen is a Russian-American journalist and staff writer at The New Yorker, whose latest book, Surviving Autocracy, makes the case that Trump's presidency has endangered American democracy and people's faith in it. Here's Gessen speaking to our Michelle Martin about the road ahead.
Thanks, Christian. Masha Gessen, thank you so much for being with us once again.
It's great to be here.
You've written extensively about the rise of authoritarian regimes in recent years, and a lot of your focus has been on Europe. But sadly, in recent years, you've also applied that analysis to the United States. And recently, for your piece in The New Yorker, you said that Donald Trump has been engaged in an autocratic attempt for the last 3 years. And you said that he's now trying to stage an autocratic breakthrough. And I know you're borrowing a bit of the analysis here from a Hungarian sociologist, but you just briefly tell us what you mean by that.
So I've been using a framework developed by Hungarian sociologist Balint Magyar. And he divides, he has studied extensively sort of democratic backsliding over the last couple of decades. And he's developed this framework for thinking about autocracy that is divided into three stages: autocratic attempt, autocratic breakthrough, and autocratic consolidation. And they sound fairly explanatory, but what deserves attention is the difference between an autocratic attempt and autocratic breakthrough. An autocratic attempt is the stage when it is still possible to reverse it through electoral means. An autocratic breakthrough is the moment that that becomes impossible, the moment or the period in time when it becomes impossible. And that's really what we're seeing now. We have voted Donald Trump out of office. He's refusing to leave office. He is trying to create a situation where it will be impossible to remove him by peaceful means. So that's the battle we're seeing now.
What is most concerning to you about this period? As we are speaking now, the president is refusing to concede and demanding that the votes stop being counted in certain states that where the trend is has moved against him. So what is it that's most concerning to you about this period? Because some people say, oh, well, he's just throwing a tantrum. It'll all be over soon. Do you think so?
I hope it's all over soon, but he's not just throwing a tantrum. He has the Republican Party behind him. At this point, we have, what, 2.5 Republican senators who have recognized the results of an election?
It's been 4.
Oh, now we have 4. Okay. Mm-hmm. We have 4 Republican senators who have recognized the results of the election. Only 2 of them at the same time that that the rest of the country did. This is extraordinary. We have the Attorney General instructing the Justice Department to investigate what he's calling credible challenges to the vote count. An unprecedented move, right, to investigate challenges to the vote count before the votes have been certified. So what we're actually seeing is an attempt to solidify what, again, Magyar calls the vertical of vassalage. And this idea of vertical, I think, is super important. You know, when we think about democratic government, we think about it kind of horizontally. We think about a system of checks and balances in which different branches of government interact in more or less a horizontal fashion, right? We have a distribution of powers and we have checks on the power that are exerted by the other branches of government. In a vertical system, you have the autocrat and who is the command center and the people who receive commands and power and money from the autocrat. And that's what Donald Trump has tried to create, right? He's tried to create a vertical of people who owe him loyalty and who look to him for direction. And he is trying to assert that that has been created. Bill Barr is a part of his vertical. Mitch McConnell is a part of his vertical. I think he believes that the Supreme Court is a part of his vertical, right? He appointed 3 justices to the Supreme Court using Mitch McConnell. And we keep hearing these, you know, the hope expressed that the election will go to the Supreme Court because, of course, the Supreme Court is packed with people who owe Trump a debt of loyalty.
Why do you think it is that the American public to this point doesn't seem more disturbed by this? I mean, as you pointed out in your piece, 65, 70 million people consciously chose Donald Trump as their president, as their choice, despite seeing these autocratic tendencies over the last 4 years, as you described. And yet Americans, some of the people who supported him, seem more concerned about being told to wear a mask on their face to prevent the spread of disease than they are being sort of told who's going to be president, no matter who voted or not. And I'm just wondering, what do you think about that?
So I think there are two topics here, right? One is why Americans not more disturbed about what we're watching, which is basically an attempted coup, right? This attempt at an autocratic breakthrough. And I think there's part of that is kind of a healthy reaction, right? Part of it is that we have a president who should no longer be taken seriously. He's a lame duck, has been voted out of office. He's throwing a tantrum. At the same time, he's throwing a tantrum as the commander-in-chief, which of course is the symbolic meaning of firing the defense secretary at this point, right? It's to assert his power as attorney, as commander in chief. But more than that, I would be really concerned about the Republican Party. Right? The 48 senators who are not recognizing the results of a fair and, not greatly fair in the sense that lots of people, especially people of color, had to stand in line for hours and hours and hours, not terribly open in that sense, but as good an election as we can muster under our current system. Right? And that should be disturbing, right? That elected officials are undermining the results of an election. That's terrifying. The other thing, of course, that's terrifying is that, yes, 70 million people voted for him. This was not a repudiation. In fact, you know, if you look at the percentages in this election, not the turnout, right? We had record turnout, but if you look at the percentages by which Biden won the popular vote and the Electoral College, it looks like a normal American election. And there's nothing normal about throwing an autocrat out of office.
Clearly, I don't see him that way. In fact, Mitch McConnell, who's the Senate Majority Leader, a senator from Kentucky, who has certainly been supportive of President Trump's aims, you know, throughout his presidency, and really, frankly, in advance of his presidency, by holding open so many seats, by refusing to advance qualified nominees for the judiciary in the hopes that a Republican president would then take over. I mean, he created the soil for this to grow, at least as far as the judiciary is concerned. He says that the president is doing the most American thing possible, which is taking his beef to court. He says that's what Americans do.
Apparently. You know, I don't think the problem is that people don't recognize Trump as an autocrat. I think the Republican Party has turned into an autocratic party. And in my book, Surviving Autocracy, I talk about how I think we can distinguish an autocratic party from a democratic party, a democratic party with a small d. The audience of a democratic party, the political addressee, are the voters. But however imperfect our democratic party may be, and it's hugely imperfect, you can always tell that when we see our politicians speak, they speak to the voters. They speak to the people that they perceive as themselves as being accountable to. When we see Republicans speak, they have an audience of one. And that audience is Donald Trump.
Is there something about the sort of Republican electorate at this point that finds this stance and this posture so appealing that the people who are elected by them, that's where they are as well? Seems as though there's a great appetite for this among certain sectors of the American people. And so the question I have for you is why? Why do you think that is?
You know, social psychologists have studied what makes people want autocracy for at least since Hitler rose to power. And I think that the theory developed by Erich Fromm, who was a German social psychologist, is actually the most illuminating. He had this theory that there are times in human history when people feel so dislocated, so economically anxious, so fearful of the future that it is easier to hand their agency over to an autocrat in exchange to the promise of stability. The autocrats never deliver the promise of stability, but there's this emotional promise of predictability, stability, and the message that you don't have to talk to think about your future. I will lead you to into it. I will constrain you enough to make it not so unpredictable and so frightening. And so Fromm's theory was that, a time of great sort of human movement and a huge number of refugees in the wake of World War I and incredible economic anxiety is what handed power to Hitler. I think from what little we know about why people vote for Trump, we can apply that theory to the United States. Donald Trump does speak directly to economic anxieties. He speaks directly to anxieties, right? And I'm not sure that Democrats have been as successful in it, at it. If you look at the election's results, a weird disconnect between policies that people seem to like and the politicians that they vote for actually testifies to this hypothesis, right? People want to be taken care of. People want, you know, Medicare for all. People want a $15 minimum wage in Florida, right? They vote for it. And then they vote for these blustering autocrats.
I'm interested in your take on what should happen now, assuming that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris do successfully take the presidency.
I think two things should happen now. One is they should address the problem of this vertical that Trump has tried to create, right? We're assuming that this vertical is weak enough that his autocratic breakthrough will fail. But it needs to be dismantled. It cannot remain a part of government. That really means thinking hard about what made it possible, right? Biden will need to look at the courts, will need to look at the possibility of expanding the Supreme Court, but also how to address the court packing. Again, when we talk about autocracies in other countries, we talk about what Trump has done with appointing more than 200 federal judges as court packing. Because he has not simply exploited the system that we have for appointing federal judges. He has abused the system that we have for appointing federal judges by appointing a number of politically extreme and inexperienced judges that owe him a debt of loyalty. They wouldn't be there if not for him, which is very different from exploiting the system as it's designed to political ends, right? So I think thinking about this as a vertical and as this dismantling the vertical is one task that's super important. And I think the other super important task is reckoning. You know, we have come to sort of fetishize moving on ever since Ford pardoned Nixon, or more recently, Barack Obama decided not to prosecute and not to investigate illegal detention and torture under the George W. Bush administration. Right, there's this idea that letting sleeping dogs lie is somehow a virtue. But what it really communicates is that after a certain level of power, you always have immunity. And it also communicates that the trauma that we have lived through over the last 4 years, you know, the trauma of watching this president flail and abuse power, the trauma of watching the first family use the presidency as an annex to their personal business. The trauma for immigrants of being afraid daily, or for people who are not immigrants of being somehow complicit in creating that fear. You know, the trauma of seeing a pandemic and an executive branch that sees your lives and the lives of your friends and family as disposable, as worthless. The trauma of a call for reckoning with racism, to which the president responds by flaming racism, right? We can't go into the future carrying that with us. That is unfair and painful and too much to ask of the American population to just set that aside and continue as though we're going back to some kind of normal. We need a reckoning, right? And I think that there's been a lot of conversation about whether do we prosecute, is that vengeance, or do we create truth and reconciliation commissions? And I think those are the wrong questions. I think the question is, do we have a national commitment, a commitment that's led by the president, the new president, to think about, to talk about what happened to us and what made it possible? There has to be a commitment to a national conversation and to creating a story about what happened to us. And that attempt to create a story is the best chance we have to actually create a shared reality.
I hate to ask you to do this, but I am going to ask you to do this. Assess the damage for us from your perspective. I mean, how bad do you think the damage has been to our democracy, even if the Biden-Harris ticket does prevail in the end and takes hold? And is this reversible?
That's the $64,000 question, right? Is this reversible? Right? At this point, if the Biden-Harris ticket takes power, and I think it will, right? We will have prevented the autocratic breakthrough right now. I keep flashing back to Hungary, where Viktor Orban, after his first term in office. And Viktor, Hungary was for a brief period, but a thriving liberal democracy. And Viktor Orban was elected, voted out of office after one term, spent two election cycles as the leader of the opposition, and then swept back in on a supermajority and changed the constitution. And that to me is one of the biggest reminders of in recent history to not just move on and sweep things under the rug. The preconditions for an autocrat in the United States exist. They existed before Donald Trump came into office. He managed to do an incredible amount of damage to the functioning and the structures and the credibility of American institutions. And we have to repair the damage. Otherwise, possibly not Donald Trump, possibly one of his kids, will be running for office in 4 years, in 8 years. And that vertical of power that Trump has tried to build, will be there waiting for them.
Moshe Gessen, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother, and he's welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast episode. I have this fear. I don't like to talk about it, but I'm going to talk about it now. Before I actually talk about it, let me set this up a little bit. After Joe Biden won the presidency, I'm talking after he was actually declared the winner, I watched various live streams on YouTube showcasing the people celebrating
throughout the country, in the streets, celebrating throughout the United States of America, in the streets, because a president had won and had defeated another president who they saw as a threat to the nation. On Monday, when I returned back to work, a friend of mine who often talks politics with me and I were talking about Biden's win and the people celebrating. And I said to him that I viewed the celebration like I viewed a movie. How so, he asked. I said, well, you know, there's these movies where 20 or 30 minutes in, all of the characters will, and, you know, maybe movie is the wrong answer, maybe a, you know, a series. But anyway, 20 or 30 minutes in, the main characters will defeat something that looked almost unbeatable. And they and the people around them will celebrate and they'll enjoy it and they'll praise God like there will never be any problem again. Only to find 20 minutes later that the real threat reveals itself. And those celebratory praises are shattered. That idea of being out of trouble is shattered. I have maintained this view. I have maintained it. And the reason I have maintained it is because I can feel in this country a mood that has not been extinguished with the defeat of Donald Trump. It is a mood that many, many well-meaning, good people have not bothered to try to understand or even to acknowledge that it exists. It is not a mood of desperateness. It's not a mood of despair. It's not a mood of depression. It is something far more frightening. Something that I've not felt before. Something that the resonances from my ancestral lineage tells me is not good. My father, who was born in Jim Crow South, he was born in Jim Crow, Louisiana, in fact, and spent his childhood down in Jim Crow, Louisiana, before moving to Philadelphia. But he was back and forth between, especially during summer in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, which he had a lot of family down there. We have a lot of family down there. But in explaining to me how life was different then, because he was born in the late 30s. And thus, by the time the Civil Rights Movement really picked up and started having some legislative accomplishments, you know, my father was in his mid-20s. So, you know, question which I had for him at one point was, how really was it living under Jim Crow? And he once answered to me,
that the scent of death, the scent of annihilation, was in the air all the time if you were black in the Jim Crow South. Now, they didn't speak about it, they didn't talk about it, and they did everything they could do to make sure that that stench remained only in the air, that it didn't become active, because it was almost like it was a cue, like it was gasoline, or not, I guess, gasoline, but gas fumes, and one spark would cause a white person to go crazy and gather a bunch of other white people to lynch a bunch of folks. So the goal was to allow that stench, as crazy as it was, to just stay in the air. Don't ignite it. Tamp down the sparks. I remember asking him, what do you mean annihilation was in the air? I mean, how could you tell that? And he said, you could tell it. Trust me, you could tell it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's in the air. It is in the air. It's thick. Though, for a time, I thought it was easing, but it's still there. My fear is there is going to be a spark that sets it off. Now, I want to be clear here. This stench isn't there naturally. Though, the underlying cause of it, the need for dominance, particularly white dominance over non-white people, has always been there. It is that need for dominance that causes white people to call those black people who demand respect aggressive. It is that need for dominance which causes white people to look upon those black people and brown people who are saying, we cannot allow you to injure us the way you've injured us, to say that they're being unpatriotic. Well, just like gasoline can be dissipated with clean air, that dominance, that waft of dominance, is thinning because of the demographic change that's occurring in this country. And so now, that elemental resonance which my father spoke about, which existed in the South, which probably existed back in the 1800s, whenever white folks started dominating a region, this scent would come in, this annihilation scent, which would allow them to be triggered into devastating Native American and black communities in order to take their land. That's back. That's back. The dangerous part in this is that it is not a feeling which has been motivated by desires that have been suppressed. This is a feeling that has been created and has been nourished and it's been nurtured over the past 40, 50 years. Now, in the 60s, this annihilation tendencies, and also in the 50s, was starting to be dissipated, was starting to be taken away from the country. The country had shuddered and with fear and learned as it watched Germany go through what it went through and said, we will never let ourselves be like this. And so there was a concerted effort by the forces of goodwill to tame the forces of ill will and to win over as many people as they could in the country to dissipate that annihilation instinct which white people in this country have used for so long to ensure that they remained top dogs here. But as is being revealed in a wonderful book titled The Invisible Bridge by Rick Perlstein, Richard Nixon in the 70s took that away. And that annihilation instinct began to build back up. With the invention of corporate conservative media, particularly radio, the anger, the confusion, the illusionment, and the egoism that was required to deaden the soul and weaken the spiritual fortitude of people, to allow for this annihilation instinct to be fed, by the spirit, that was created, and that was nourished. And it took some time because the annihilation instinct was so weak. It was so very much weakened by the sacrifices and humility and movements of the 60s that it took years, decades, to rebuild that up, to build that web back up, to build that aroma back up. And it's been only over the past 6 to 8 years, maybe even 10, that it has built up in sufficient amounts that it is now presenting a danger to the country. Occupy Wall Street started dissipating it. Black Lives Matter started dissipating it. But it was Trump who stoked it. I don't think he even knew what he was doing. But he did. And the air has gotten so much heavier since he was elected. He stoked it. And now it is in such vast amounts that the despair created by COVID-19, the depression created by COVID-19, the economic devastation that will be in effect for the foreseeable future, even after Joe Biden takes office. That's going to make this annihilation It's going to make it thicker. When you have the stench of annihilation in the air. It infects people. It distorts people. It allows anger to become a motivating factor in how they respond to the world. And it twists them into taking that anger and rationalizing it into first acts which could be destructive to the person, but then acts which would be destructive to other people. The shooter from Kenosha was clearly acting with assistance from that annihilation resonance. Clearly acting that way. Now, another fear I have, the biggest fear I have, was helped along by one Christopher Hedges. Chris Hedges, ladies and gentlemen. It just so happened that at the conclusion of the summer, I had found this, well, near the conclusion of the summer, I had found this podcast episode. I believe it was part of a podcast called For the Wild. This episode included Chris Hedges in an interview. The interview was conducted in, I believe, the spring of 2018. Might have even been the spring of 2019. Anyway, actually, it would have been the spring of 2019 because they were talking about the Democratic primary. Chris Hedges said something that I thought was massively prescient. And my fear now is that Chris Hedges is going to be a prophet. Because what he said is going to come true. What did he say? He said that the Democrats would likely, you know, choose a moderate, and that the party would push for austerity once when they got into office. Again, this is 2019. This is way before before COVID-19 was even on the radar. That they would push for austerity, and that would make the suffering of the people even worse, and that would bring about, that would bring something, somebody into power who would make Trump look like a Boy Scout. Ladies and gentlemen, my fear is that he's right. My fear is that he is right. The Democrats selected Joe Biden. Joe Biden eked out a win. And I think he's going to push for austerity at a time when we don't need it. And the pain, which is going to be evident while he's doing austerity, is going to result in something frightening. As he said in the interview, the Nazis were polling in the single digits. They had no support until the Social Democrats went into office and did austerity. And then the Nazis rose like the phoenix and took over. Now you're saying to yourself, that could never happen here in the United States. I mean, who's going to play the part of the Nazis? A little reported story that came out of this election. It's very little. Across the country, the Libertarian Party, I'm not saying they're Nazi-esque, but they're definitely fascist. Libertarian candidates in a couple of states were able to hit the 5% threshold. Now, not the presidential, but candidates throughout, you know, I think most of them were running for the Congress, House of Representatives. What this means is, if my research is correct, it might have changed, and I probably should have. Anyway, that means that as long as it's on the books in that state, they will be eligible for campaign help from the federal government. Now, that's a little something. A little. Not much, just a little. But ladies and gentlemen, the interesting thing to note with what Chris Hedges said is that in this country, socialism and the left have been made into demonic phrases. The right and corporatist policies have been made into divinity and divine statements. That is your saving grace. Therefore, the closer you move to fascism, the more divine you're actually reaching. That is what has happened and been transplanted into the minds of people over the last 100+ years. And even today, we talk about conservative media. These folks are pushing corporatist agenda. They are not conservatives. They are corporatists. That's what they are pushing. And so when times get tough, as they likely will, I think it was Tom Hartman who I was listening to, who was going through a list of things that Trump wants to do before he leaves office. And it's frightening. Some of them are economic, and they will cause devastation. When times get rough, people are going to go to the right. They're going to go towards the corporatists. And my fear is what is that move to the right is going to accompany an authoritarian mind state, which then seeks to recapture the glory days of this country. And ladies and gentlemen, we have to be very, very, very upfront with what these people mean by the glory days of America. I know a lot of people are big on trying to equate things. You know, racism is like sexism, is like homophilia, things like that. But the reality is, for the repression that homosexuals had to deal with during the period of time that America was considered great in, for the repression that even women had to deal with. And here I'm talking white women, because there was a major difference during that period. It was the non-white peoples who were ostracized, who were executed extrajudicially. During that period of time, the dominance resonance moved people to treat non-white people like trash. You could kill a whole score of non-white people and nobody would care. Native Americans could tell you about that. Black people could tell you about that. This is not to say that there wasn't battles between labor, white labor, and white industrialists. There were. But most of the time, the visions that were shared by a lot of those laborites did not compel them, should I say, to move over and share the same burden of black people and brown people and red people and say that, you know, son, it's all connected. And it's a shame, but it's the truth. My fear is that that is where we're heading. Make America great again. When was America great? When? I've asked people who support Donald Trump that, and I've never received the answer because I don't think they know, but I know. I know when the wealthy are talking about. My fear is that we're going back there. That we're going back to a nation of industrial fiefdoms. The difference is these fiefdoms won't be that industrial anymore. That's my concern. That is it. Nothing more than that, just that. I had somebody send me a message about communitarianism, and it's kind of hilarious what hierarchically obsessed minds do with concepts that are supposed to be beautiful. The person who sent it to me sent a message along with it, basically saying that, you know, the biggest threat to freedom was this idea of communitarianism. And I send back to them an interesting question. Because I know about communitarianism. I did a little bit of research on it back in 2010. Actually, it might have been 2010. But I wrote to them and I asked them, I said, you know, why is it that all of these great concepts are always seen as threats? Socialism, which really does boil down to looking at the impact that your actions are going to have on society. You know, it's not just about you. It's bigger than just you. How is this going to impact the society? And how can you mitigate the bad stuff? So like if you have a company, you know, and you know you're going to produce some waste. How do you make sure that that waste does the least amount of damage? Okay. How is it that communism, a concept that is older than Karl Marx, significantly older than Karl Marx, The idea of communes are not new. How did that, which is a commune is something, you know, where you are, where everybody is cooperating to make sure that it works well, how did that become disgusting? And now we have communitarianism. How is that? You know, so I asked him that. And he had no answer to that inquiry. He just wanted me to be aware. And I'm glad that he made me aware of it. I didn't know what, you know, some people were taking communitarianism and doing with it presently. But basically, what they're doing with communitarianism is using it as a new communism and just creating fiefdoms out of it. So pretty much they're reinstating feudalism, and with the community being part of the feudal territory. Which, again, just, you know, to me it seems like communism rebranded or restructured. But, yeah, we need new concepts that are, that depart from, corporatism and the like. Even fascism. We need new structures that go the other way. For the life of me, and actually this is something that does give me hope, I never understood why people would just say it's bad because it didn't work once. So communism is bad because it didn't work once. Really? Okay. The great thing about the new generation is they're not taking that. They're saying, you know, so wait a minute. Let's look at this again. Let's see if it really is bad. And with communism, what I always tell people, and people don't like this because we've all been brainwashed to see USSR as bad and communism bad, is that the USSR took communism and put it over a pre-existing structure. That structure was actually antithetical to communism. Oh, well, are you a communist? No, but I've looked at it and I see the problems that emerged from it. Plus, it, as it was enacted, it didn't actually go with human nature. It went with those who were power hungry and wanted power. So, you know, that's a whole different story. But, I digress. We are really at a crossroads. I keep saying it. I know I keep saying it. I know you're tired of hearing it. But we are. And it is so telling and somewhat chilling that we have a party that is headed, led, at least in the House and Senate nationally, and really off, well, both parties are led by people whose ideas were formed in the 1960s and 70s, and not necessarily, you know, for the good of themselves and the generation that came after them in the country. And as sad as it is, Mark Blythe may be right when he says society evolves one funeral at a time. And it's sad, but it's also true. The crossroads, which has been a long time coming, repudiates the worst aspects of the 60s. Repudiates it. And for this generation, Generation E for equilibrium, which is seeking desperately to bring the planet back into balance, to bring us back into balance, and to stop us from annihilating ourselves. The generation that has started this, put us into this position, should I say, we will answer the question, where will we go when we finally wrestle control of the country from their hands? Not before then. And the problem that I keep seeing, you know, because I came to that conclusion some time ago, the problem that I keep seeing is that, again, Mark Blythe said it, is that these people are determined to live forever and not to relinquish control of the country, which means what exactly? What does it mean? How are we going to finally be able to turn the tide on a lot of these problems if they're not willing to let go? When that happens in a society, ladies and gentlemen, that typically, when you have such a contrast in what needs to happen and what is being forced into place, particularly by people who are massively disconnected from the populace, what happens generally in history is clashing, physical clashing. When Donald Trump was elected, I said, and I know many people poo-pooed this, they didn't want to listen to this, I said many times, the elite are in a civil war. I should have probably said a cold civil war, but indeed, I still believe it. They have this, looking at the elite and how they've responded to this, and some of the things that some of the elite are saying in the newspaper, and yet what some of the elite are saying in the newspaper that Congress, the Senate and such should do, and then watching what the Senate and Congress, Senate and the House of Representatives, actually does, that tells me that there is a portion of the elite that is desperately trying to get what is needed out to the people because they see how important it is. And there is another faction which is saying, screw everybody else, just take care of the businesses, just take care of us. And once I recognized that earlier this year, I realized I saw the same thing in Rome. The books that I've been listening to about Rome. The same thing happened. Now, in Rome, it resulted in the elite literally getting into a physical civil war. The question is that what's going to happen here? Is that what's going to happen here? I hope not. My fear is that we are already well down the road towards that path. Lawrence Wilkerson was being interviewed by Paul Jay, formerly of the Real News Network. He's now on the the Analyst News, ladies and gentlemen, the Analyst News, www.theanalystnews.com, the Analyst News Podcast. You can see him on YouTube, which is where I have him at. But he was interviewing Larry Wilkerson, former chief of staff to Colin Powell, who actually said that he sees America in relationship to Civil War. 4 years out from, well, technically five, from when the first Civil War began. Right now. He said 1856. And ladies and gentlemen, he's not wrong. If I remember correctly, the interview took place before the election. If I remember correctly. Yes, it took place before the election. And look, he could be wrong. But ladies and gentlemen, the reason why I'm putting this out is because the instinct that my father spoke about is motivating me to see something that only the sixth sense could taste. I don't believe Lawrence Wilkerson is wrong. But I do believe we can change the course of history, or at least the course that we are on. That stated, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. I'm sorry for the slow nature of this today, but there is more to come, I suppose. I will see you on the next one. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick.